whimpered.
"Our stateroom," Brashen announced tightly. His eyes roved over us. "Follow me." He glanced at his crew and added, "About your duties, please." The last was a concession, I felt, to those sailors who had stayed aboard the Paragon. Not many had. If we sailed, which I was beginning to doubt, we'd have a skeleton crew indeed. Paragon's voice boomed out into the quiet harbour.
"I will have what I want, Brashen. I will."
"Oh, I don't doubt it," he replied bitterly. Althea had already turned away. Brashen spun and followed to lead us aft. The chamber was large for a ship, but never designed to be packed with so many people. I let Amber sit and stood behind her, my hands on the back of her chair. I had positioned her so that I could study every person in the room. Sorkor was a contrast. I judged him to be a man past his middle years, used hard by his early life, but now in a safe harbour. He dressed as befitted a minor noble, but the scars on his face and the wear on his hands were those of a fighter and a sailor. The sword at his side was of excellent and deadly quality. There was something in the cut of his clothing and the selection of his jewellery that spoke of a man who'd known poverty, suddenly given the chance to dress in fine fabric and gold. On another man, it might have looked laughable. On him, it looked earned. Brashen thudded two bottles down on the table, brandy and rum. Althea followed it with a clatter of cups.
"Your choice, and pour for yourself,"
she announced wearily before dropping into a chair. For a moment, she lowered her face into her hands. Then, as Brashen came and set his hands on her shoulders, she lifted her head and straightened her back. Her eyes were resigned. Wintrow spoke.
"Queen Etta isn't going to like any of this. She was already alarmed when she got word that a live ship was being brought in for tariff violation. That simply doesn't happen. The traders understand taxes and tariffs well, and none of them want the delays and fines that violations bring. As soon as I knew it was Paragon, I went to her immediately. She feared..."
He stopped and abruptly chose another word.
"She considered it best if the prince were located and his introduction to his father's ship monitored, so to speak."
He gave Sorkor a sideways glance.
"He's a young man,"
Sorkor objected.
"Somehow he knew what my mission was and kept clear of me. I suspect he paid his guards to turn a blind eye. I'll see to their stripes tomorrow. So here we are. What now?"
"Coming aboard!"
A woman's voice, imperious and angry. Wintrow and Sorkor exchanged a look.
"Queen Etta is not recalcitrant in acting on a situation."
Sorkor snorted and looked at Brashen. "That big word means she might have a sword out. Look to yourselves and make no fast moves." He whipped the hat from his head. I saw how he fell naturally into a fighter's stance. Brashen moved away from Althea, closer to the door, as if he would protect her, but her dark eyes blazed, and she came to her feet and stood beside him. Queen Etta's voice reached us again.
"Out of my way! I've told you I don't need you for this! You are embarrassing me, and my chief minister is going to hear of this! Standing orders should fall before my command. Wait in the boat if you must, but get out of my way!"
"She just dismissed the guard I assigned to her,"
Wintrow observed mildly. And in the next instant, the door framed an extraordinary woman. She was tall, and the planes of her face were angular. She was not beautiful, but she was striking. Her glossy black hair fell loose to her shoulders, which were wide beneath a scarlet jacket. Black lace spilled from her shirt front and cuffed her wrists. Gold hoops dangled boldly from her ears, and close to her throat, almost nestled in the lace, she wore a necklace carved in a man's image. Kennet? If so, the son strongly resembled the father. She also wore a sword on a wide black belt, studded with silver,
but it resided still in its sheath. She rested the back of her fingers on its elaborate hilt. The glance that raked the room was sharper than any blade as she demanded,
"Are you conspiring?"
Wintrow tilted his head at her.
"Of course we are, and we would welcome your company. The issue is your strong-willed and rather spoiled heir, who has recently met his father's strong-willed and rather spoiled ship. They seem intent on taking up with each other on a voyage to Clarys. I've been given to understand that the purpose of this voyage is to exact vengeance on a monastery there for the kidnapping and murder of a child, and that afterward this vessel will magically change himself into two dragons."
Etta's mouth hung slightly ajar as Wintrow looked to Althea and asked,
"Do I have that mostly right?"
Althea shrugged.
"Close enough."
And the two women exchanged cold looks. Queen Etta said nothing. Wintrow spoke cautiously.
"The Spice Island delegation?"
"Have plenty of folk to lose their coins to. I'll join them at the card table or not at all. It matters little to me now."
She turned a furious look on Althea and Brashen.
"Why have you brought this ship here? What do you want of us, of Kennetson? My son is not going anywhere. He is the heir to this kingdom and is needed here. He is supposed to be enjoying an evening with the merchants from the Spice Islands and his potential bride, not planning a sea voyage."
Her gaze roved over all of us, her eyes cold.
"And whatever vengeance you seek, it has nothing to do with us. So why have you come here? What sort of discord do you attempt to sow? Why bring this vessel and its ill reputation and bad luck to our harbour? It was my wish that he never see or set foot on this ship."
"There we agree," Althea replied quietly.
I felt the pirate queen force herself to look at Althea.
"But not for the same reasons,"
she said stiffly.
"My son has had a fascination with his ship ever since he was old enough to know how his father died. Kennet's last blood soaked into the planks of this deck. His memories, his life, was taken into it, absorbed. And from the time my son was old enough to be told of such things, he has possessed a wild curiosity to see this ship, to be aboard it, in the hope of speaking to his father. We have told him over and over that Paragon is not his father. His father makes up just a part of the life that the ship embodies. But it is a hard thing to make someone understand."
Althea spoke in a flat voice.
"I doubt that anyone not born to Bingtown trader stock can fully understand what that means."
Queen Etta stared at her coldly.
"Kennet was born of Bingtown stock, a Ludluck, and his son carries that blood, even if he prefers the name Kennetson."
Her hand rose to clutch at her necklace.
"And perhaps I understand more of this ship than you think. Paragon himself spoke to me of these things. Plus,"
she tipped her head toward Wintrow,
"I have had your own nephew as my advisor in these matters."
"Then perhaps you will understand what Paragon has suffered. In his days as Igrot's ship, he absorbed many deaths, probably more than any other live ship. And even before that, when he belonged to the Ludluck family, his fortune seemed to be cursed. He has never been stable. For a time, he was known in Bingtown as the Pariah, as the mad ship, the live ship that would kill any crew that sought to sail him."
"I know that,"
queenly disdain in her tone. Then Etta cocked her head and was suddenly, disarmingly human, as she said,
"Althea, do you think I have not been visited by Malta and Rain? Do you think I have not heard every detail of the tale of this ship and his history?"
She looked down at the pendant she clutched and added more quietly,
"Perhaps it is possible that I understand even more than you do of this ship."
Both women fell silent. I felt as if fate balanced on a tiny point, waiting to shift and choose a direction. Was this what the fool had meant when he told me of infinite futures, poised and waiting, but only one that would become real? Were we all witnesses to that? Yet it was Brashen who spoke.
The past haunts everyone here. Walk away from it, please. There is no sense in arguing who better understands live ships or Paragon. That's not our problem right now. And before we speak about the future, I would like to settle the present, as it affects Althea and me and my crew.
He ran his gaze over us all. No one spoke.
When Althea and I spoke with Wintrow after we first went ashore, he agreed to help us meet our most basic needs, to send messenger birds back to our trading partners at Bingtown and in the Rain Wilds, assuring them that we intended no larceny when we did not stop in either Bingtown or Jamalia. Queen Etta, we would ask your help in selecting trustworthy ships and captains bound to those ports who would be willing to deliver our goods to their proper destinations, so that our words as honourable traders remains untarnished. If you can aid us in that, we could consider it a great favour to both our families.
Etta looked at Wintrow and nodded.
That can be done,
Wintrow spoke softly.
I know several captains whom I trust.
Brashen's relief was plain.
And I think we all agree that it would be a great mistake to have Kennetson accompany us on Paragon's mad errand. We must all ensure that he can't board before we depart. He must be kept away from the harbour and the ship, for Paragon cannot seek him out on the land.
He lifted a hand.
If we keep them separated, Paragon may remain in the harbour, obsessed with Kennetson, and give up this quest. But I consider that unlikely. I think his desire to recreate himself as dragons will be stronger than his will to have Kennetson make a final voyage with him.
I agree,
Wintrow began, and then halted. His startled gaze met Brashen's. Althea rocketed to her feet while Sorkor asked in a harsh whisper,
What is that?
Sailors all, they were aware before I was of a subtle change in the ship. In a matter of breathless moments, I felt the list, and Althea cried out,
He's taking on water!
Brashen took two large steps and seized the handle of the door, but the door was wedged tight against a sill that had been eased out of alignment. The ship's timbers groaned, and the panes of the windows made an indescribable sound as the ship flexed. Paragon's voice boomed over the ship and the harbour's waters.
I could kill you all, drown you right here in the harbour. How dare you stand on my deck and plot against me?
Amber's fingers dug suddenly into my forearm. I'll break a window, I assured her. Spark clutched at Purr, in the sisterly way of someone who seizes the youngest, preparatory to snatching him out of harm's way. Lant took each of them by a shoulder and herded them toward me. We clustered close in the slowly tipping room. Sorkor had moved to Etta's side. He reminded me of a battered watchdog taking up his duties. Etta seemed unaware of him. Her jaw was set, forming some plan of her own. I watched Brashen. If he moved, I would. Until then.
But I shall not.
The ship's voice thundered through my chest.
Not now. And not just because Boyo would be trapped in there with you.
Boyo was standing pale-faced, gripping the edge of the table, his eyes showing white all around. I realized he believed the threat. Ice filled my spine and belly.
Paragon, let me out. Allow us to come forward and discuss this in a way that doesn't involve all of the Pirate Isles.
Brashen spoke as a father to his child, his words calm and firm. His hand still rested on the door handle.
But it does.
Paragon's booming voice came from outside. I did not doubt that all in the harbour and in the shoreside structures could hear him.
It involves them all if they keep their prince from me. For he is my blood before he became their prince. The prince that Kennet could not have made without me.
He's mad, Etta said in a low whisper. I'll happily die here, drowned inside him before he shall have my son.
You won't die here, Queen Etta.
Sorkor picked up one rum bottle and hefted it thoughtfully, looking at the windows.
I don't swim, she said faintly. Paragon is not going to sink,
Althea declared firmly, and I wondered if her determination alone could protect us. From outside the stateroom door, Ant's voice reached us.
Sir, I've an axe. Shall I chop my way in?
Not yet,
Brashen ordered to my surprise. Then, to my even greater shock, there came another woman's voice. It rang with authority and was fully as loud as Paragon's.
Harm my family, and I'll see you burn, you faithless pariah. Vivacia,
Althea gasped.
Burn me, Paragon howled. To save your family? Do you think your family matters more to you than mine does to me? Set fire to me, and they'll cook inside me like meat in an oven. Paragon!
Boyo bellowed the name.
Would you truly do that to me, who was born on your decks and learned to walk here?
The breath he drew shuddered into his lungs.
You named me! You called me Boyo, your Boyo, because you would not call me Trelvestrit. You said I was yours, and that name did not fit me.
A sudden deep silence followed these words. It swelled and deafened us. Then a deep, anguished groan vibrated the deck beneath us. I wondered if the others felt, as I did, a welling of unbearable guilt that washed through me with the sound. I recalled every foolish thing, every evil and selfish thing I had ever done in my life. Shame surged through me so that I longed to die, invisibly and alone. Beneath our feet, the deck was slowly shifting back to level. All around us, I heard the muttering of shifting planks and beams. Then the door was thrown open to reveal a panicky Ant holding an axe. Several crew surrounded her.
The danger has passed,
Brashen said to her, but I was not sure I agreed.
All you crewmen who remain, see to our cargo. Any wet crates, bring them up onto the deck. I know, working in the dark. It can't be helped. I want to be able to offload tomorrow as swiftly as possible.
A brief pause, and then he added,
All hatch covers to be open, and remain so.
Sir,
Ant agreed in a shaky voice, and darted off. Brashen stepped through the door and headed forward, Althea at his heels and Boyo beside her, and we all followed.
I hate this, I said quietly to Amber.
Don't we all? She muttered.
It feels as if my entire future lies outside my control. I want to get off this insane ship and away from these people. I want to leave now.
On the deck, I led her to the railing and stared toward the scattered lights of the pirate town. We can demand to go ashore, use our Rainwild gifts to buy passage on a different vessel, regain some control over our journey, and send Lant and the youngsters home and out of danger.
Are we back to that?
Lant shook his head.
It will not happen, Fitz. I won't go home until you go with me, and it would be foolish and dangerous to send those two off alone on a long voyage with people we do not know. Whatever we face, I feel they are safer with us.
It's not a matter of safer for me,
Purr muttered darkly. I ignored them all and stared at the lights. I wanted to shake all over like a wolf would shake off the rain and run off alone into the darkness to do what I must. I felt caged by responsibilities. What was best for us? Then we should leave this ship tonight, all of us. Find other passage, declares.
We can't,
said the fool. Not amber. I turned my head to look at him. How did he do that? How did he shed one mask and don another so easily? Despite the rouge and powder, he turned my friend's face to me.
We have to go there on this ship, Fitz.
Why?
I told you.
He sounded both patient and exasperated, in a way only the fool could manage.
I've begun to dream again. Not many dreams, but the ones that reached me rang with clarity and with inevitability. If we are going to Clarys, we travel on this ship. It's a narrow channel I navigate to reach my goal, and only Paragon provides us a passage to the future I must create.
But you never thought to share that information with me until this moment. I did not try to keep the accusation out of my voice. Was this a true thing, or a gambit by the fool to get what he wanted? My distrust of Amber was starting to bleed into my friendship with the fool.
The steps I have trodden to get us to Kelsingrar and then Treehog, to get us onto this ship and thence to Divitown. If I had told you of them, of the things I did, and the things I took care not to do, it would have influenced you. Only by you behaving as you would if you knew nothing of what I did, would we come here.
What? Lant asked, confused. I could not blame him. I sorted out the fool's words. So, of course, that means you can't tell me any of your other dreams and warn me what we must do. It must all be left in your hands. He set his gloved hand on the ship's railing.
Yes,
he said quietly.
Balls, said Perseverance quite distinctly.
Spark gave him a shocked look and then rebuked him with a shove. He glared at her.
Well, it's not right. It's not how friends should do things.
Perseverance, enough, I said quietly. Lant sighed.
Shouldn't we move up to the bow and see what is going on?
And when he turned and walked that way, we followed. I didn't especially want to go. The deep sobbing of the figurehead and his misery permeated the ship. I paused to reinforce my walls and then walked on with Amber. The fool spoke quietly. The others were far enough ahead that I doubt they heard him.
I won't say I'm sorry. I can't be sorry for something I must do.
I'm not sure that's entirely true, I responded. I could recall many things that I'd had to do, and many of them I regretted.
I'd be sorrier, and so would you, if I began to worry more about your feelings and less about getting to Clarys and rescuing B.
Rescuing B. His words felt like meat dangled for a starving dog. I was tired and battered by Paragon's guilt and grief. I thought your great ambition was to destroy Clarys and kill as many people as you could, or as I could kill for you.
You're angry.
When he said the words aloud, I felt ashamed, and even angrier. I stopped and stood still. I am, I admitted. This is not how I do things, fool. When I kill, I do it efficiently. I know who I'm stalking. I know how to find them and how to end them. This is madness. I'm going into unfamiliar territory. I know little of my targets, and I'm hampered with people I'm responsible for protecting. Then I discover that I'm dancing to your tune, to music I can't even hear. Answer me this, fool. Do I live through this? Does the boy, does Lant go back to Shade? And is his father still alive when he gets there? Does Spark survive? Do you?
Some things are more likely than others, he said quietly, and all of them still dance and wobble like a spun coin, dust blown on the wind, a day of rain, a tide that is lower than expected. Any and all of those things can change everything. You must know that is true. All I can do is peer into a mist and say, it looks most clear in that direction. I tell you that our best chance of finding B alive is to remain on Paragon until he arrives in Clarice.
My pride wanted me to be defiant, but my fatherhood was stronger than my pride. What would I not have done to increase the chance that I might rescue B, might hold her and protect her, and tell her how devastated I was to have failed her, to promise her that never again would she leave my protection. The others had waited for us. Amber's hand squeezed my arm as I led the way to the bow with them trooping behind me. My guard that I must protect as I led them into I knew not what. Amber queried softly,
"Is there a bright light off to our left?"
"There's a lantern on the Vivacia. It's burning very brightly." Some sort of argument was going on over on her deck, though I could not hear the details. I heard,
"Anchor!"
and then a barking of orders to roust someone out of his bed. Amber had turned her face toward the lantern light and opened her light gold eyes wide. A slight smile bowed her mouth. Her pale face reminded me of the moon as she said,
"I can perceive it. My vision is improving slowly, Fitz. So slowly. But I believe it is coming back."
"That would be good," I said, but privately I wondered if she deceived herself. At the bow of the ship, voices had been rising and falling. I recognized Althea's voice raised in a query, but did not catch the words. We were on the outer edges of those who had gathered there, for many of the crew stood between us and the figurehead. It was Paragon who responded.
"No, you of all people should know that I am not Kennet, and that Kennet does not petition you for this. Is Vivacia your father or grandmother? Of course not. It is not Kennet that demands this. It is I, Paragon. A ship made from massacred dragons, both embraced and enslaved by a Bingtown trader family. We had no say in that. No choice but to care, no choice in who we loved, as Ludlucks poured out their blood and souls and memories onto the bones of our deck. I do not ask, I demand. Do I not have the right to him, as much right as his ancestors had to me? Is it not fair?" "It is fair," a female voice, clear and carrying. Vivacia. And suddenly my mind put together the bits of what I had heard. The live ship had dragged her anchor to come closer to Paragon, not just to hear his words, but to add her voice to his. "Althea, you know it is. Were I setting out on my final voyage, would you deny me, boyo? Listen to them. They have the right to demand Kennetson, after all they have been through as the Ludluck family ship."
"What's happening over there?"
Wintrow demanded in the moment of silence that followed Vivacia's words.
"What must happen?"
Vivacia spoke before any of her crewmen could respond to their captain.
"Did you think I would not hear the truth of what Paragon had spoken? Live ship I am, and a wondrous vessel I have been for your family for generations. But Paragon is right, and deep within we all knew that we had other natures, even before the truth of the so-called Wizard Wood was revealed. I will be a dragon again, Wintrow. I know of no live ship who will not wish to rise up and fly again. So in this, I will follow Paragon,
Not just to Clares, but up the rain-wild river afterward, to demand the silver that is the right of every dragon.
You will follow Paragon to Clares.
You wish to be a dragon. Althea and Wintrow spoke simultaneously. I am considering it, the ship replied judiciously. Why Clares?
Brashen's voice was raised in complete confusion.
Why not go directly to Kelsingra? Because a memory stirs in me. A dragon memory. A memory eclipsed by human thoughts and emotions. A memory so overscarred by human experiences that I cannot be certain of anything except a feeling of anger and betrayal that rises in me at the name Clares. Dragons recall few memories of their serpent years, but there is something that I recall, something intolerable.
Yes.
Paragon flung back his head and shouted the word to the night skies. The exultation that rushed through the ship infected me. I fought against the smile that bloomed on my face. His skill was so strong, I thought to myself, and then with a shock recognized the implications of that and felt cold and shaky. I lifted Amber's hand from my forearm and said to Spark, Please take over guiding Lady Amber. I need a time alone to think. Amber clutched my shirt front.
You are leaving? You don't want to stay here and hear what is said?
I took her wrist and tugged her hand free, more roughly than I intended. I could not keep from my voice the unease and the irritation I felt with myself for not recognizing the obvious. Listening will change nothing. They will decide what becomes of us when we travel and who goes with us. I have something else I have to ponder. Spark will be with you, and Lantern Purr. But for now, I need to think.
I understand,
she said in a voice that said she did not. But my insight into the ship's ability to manipulate human emotion was too large to share with her. I strode away to the crew quarters. Empty hammocks, only a few sailors' trunks and ditty bags remained. I sat down on someone's sea chest, there in the dark and muggy hold, and pondered. I felt as if I were assembling the pieces of a broken teacup. The silver the live ships craved and the dragons so jealously guarded was the same skill I had seen on Verity's hands when he had carved his dragon. It was the raw stuff of magic, the very essence of it. I'd seen it as a thick slurry on my king's hands, watched him shape stone into a dragon with the power it gave him. In a skill-sharing dream of Verity, I'd seen a river with a wide band of silver in it, running with the water. I'd seen silver tendrilling through a vial of dragon's blood, and witnessed how it had rushed the fool's healing, just as the skill had healed and changed the children of Kelsingra. So the silver was the skill, and the skill was the magic I used with my mind to reach out to touch thoughts with shade. The fool had once insinuated that I had dragon's blood in my veins. Tarman had said I had been claimed by a dragon. Was it the stone dragon I had touched, or an echo of Verity as I had known him? I reordered that thought now. Had I inherited something in my blood, some trace of actual silver that gave me the power to push my thoughts toward others? Silver traces in the portal stones, in the skill pillars that I could use to travel. Lines of silver in the stones from which Verity had carved his dragon, and in the stone dragons that had slept until, with blood and the touch of my skill, I had woken them. Silver traces in the memory stones that held the records the Elderlings had left for us. What, then, was the skill current I used to reach out for Nettle or Dutiful? It was a force outside me. Of that I was sure, and there were others in it, powerful awarenesses that attracted and might absorb me. Who were they? Had I truly felt Verity there,
King Shrewd? How did that fit with the silver? I had too many thoughts. My mind leapt from wondering about the skill current to considering what magic I might be able to wield if I were to drink the vials of silver that Rapskull had given me. Temptation vied with fear. Would it grant me great power or a painful death? How much silver was too much for a man's body to absorb? Paragon had grown much more powerful with the silver that Amber had given him. The vials in my pack each held more than twice what he'd taken. Now his emotions exploded from him with a force that I could barely resist. Did he know what he did to humans? Did it affect me more because I'd been trained in the skill? If he understood his power and directed it, would I be able to resist it? Would anyone? When the stone dragons had risen in flight and Verity had led them to battle against the Red Ship raiders, they had affected the minds of the warriors below them. With acid breath, the powerful winds of their wings, and the blows of their lashing tails, they had destroyed our enemies. But worse had been what they did to their minds. To be overflown by the stone dragons was to lose memories. It was not that different from how the Out-Islanders had forged their captives. Even our own men on the ground had felt the effect. Even Verity's presence as a stone dragon had worked it on the guardians of Buckkeep. The recollection of how the Queen and Starling had returned to Buckkeep Castle was a hazy one for those who had witnessed it. The most common telling was that Verity had been astride a dragon when he delivered them to safety, not that the king had become a dragon. Such was the power of the skill, of silver to confuse and confound, to steal memory, and perhaps one's humanity. As my serving folk had been confounded on the night that B was taken, had they used silver or dragon's blood to work that magic, to make all my people forget how they had come and stolen my child, to forget that she had even existed? Could that same magic be used against them? I dared myself to imagine drinking the silver. Not all of it, not at first. Just a little, to see what I could do. Just sufficient to make me strong enough to resist the ship's emotions. Enough to heal the fool without losing my vision to him. Was that possible? Enough to reach out, to ask Shade's advice, perhaps to heal his body of the ravages of age and restore his mind. Could I do that? Would Nettle know more of what it could or could not do? If I drank it all, could I walk into Clara's and demand that all there kill themselves? Could it be that easy to destroy them and win back my daughter?
What are you doing down here?
Lant asked me. I turned to see him coming toward me, Purr and Spark trailing behind him. Where is Amber?
She's with the figurehead. She dismissed us. What are you doing?
Thinking. Where are the others?
Wintrow went back to Vivacia. She needs calming, I think. The Queen and Sorkor went back to Divitown. I think they will try to find Kennetson and reason with him. Brashen and Althea went to their stateroom and shut the door, and Amber had Spark fetch her pipes, and she is playing for Paragon.
He drew breath and looked around the crew quarters.
You came here to think?
Yes.
Can you think while you work?
I turned to Clef's voice. It was humid below decks, and his face ran with sweat as he stepped out of the shadowy darkness of the hold.
I was just coming to look for you. We're short of crew and we need to move freight. Some of the crates have shifted, and a few look damp. Captains wanted those up on deck. You said you'd pitch in. Now would be a good time.
I'm coming, I said.
Me too,
Lant added, and Purr nodded.
And me,
Spark asserted.
I'm part of this crew, now and to the end.
To the end, I thought morosely, and rose to follow them. A wave of vertigo swept over me such that I abruptly sat down again on the sea chest.
There you are.
Satisfaction rang in the voice in my head.
I am coming for you. Prepare for me.
Fitz? Lant asked, concern in his voice. I stood slowly. My smile held back my fear and confusion.
Tintaglia is coming for me, I said. Chapter 19. Another Ship, Another Journey.
Report to the Four. The Lurik, known as Beloved, continues to create restlessness among the other Luriks. He was caught attempting to remain in the village when the tide was coming in, and the other Luriks had already formed up to return to their cottages. He has upset those who have come to have their fortunes foretold by hypothesizing horrible calamities. He told one client that his son would marry a donkey, but that the children from that union would bring the family great joy. To another, he said simply, "How much money do you wish to give me to lie to you? My best lies are very expensive, but this one is free. You are a very wise woman to have come here to give me lots of money to lie to you." Twice I have beaten him, once with my hands and once with a strap. He begged me to lash him hard enough to tear the tattoos from his back. I believe he was sincere in desiring that. As soon as he healed and was to return to his duties in the marketplace, he clambered onto a pile of boxes and proclaimed to all that he was the true white prophet for this generation, and announced that he was being held prisoner in Clarys. He appealed to the crowd that immediately gathered to help him escape. When I seized him and shook him to silence, I was stoned by some of the onlookers, and it was only when two other guards intervened that I was able to drag him back within the walls. I believe that I have done my duty as well as any might, and I petition to be freed from responsibility for the Lurik known as Beloved. With the greatest respect, I say that I consider him both troublesome and dangerous to all. Lutius. My life had improved, or so I told myself. We were quartered in a nice cabin. The meals were regular, and Dwalia had few chances to beat me. Indeed, she seemed almost mellowed by our improved fortunes. Summer had found the seas. The winds were fresh and the storms were few. As a result of whatever glamour Vindelire had cast over me, the crew accepted my presence without comment or interest. If I lived my life from moment to moment, it was not too bad. Very little was expected of me. I fetched Dwalia's meals to the cabin and took away the empty dishes. When she walked on the deck in the afternoons with the captain, I followed at a decorous distance, in a pretense at maintaining the lady's virtue. But for now, the pretense was small. I sat on the deck outside the door of the captain's stateroom. When he had offered his stateroom to Lady Obricia, I do not think that Dwalia had realized that he expected to continue occupying it. I heard a rhythmic thudding from inside the cabin, and fondly hoped it was the top of her head against the bulkhead. The tempo was increasing, which saddened me. The times when Captain Dorful was occupying Dwalia were the most peaceful in my constrained existence. She was making little gasping shrieks now, barely audible through the stout plank walls. I heard shuffling footsteps coming down the companionway. I thought of the sea and the moving waves, and how the sunlight glittered on their tops. I thought of the seabirds flying high above us, and yet still looking so large. How big would such a bird be if it landed on the deck? As tall as me? What did they eat? Where did they nest or land to rest when we were so many days away from land? I filled my thoughts with those wide-winged white birds and thought of nothing else. When Vindelire crouched beside me, I wondered what he would look like if he were a bird. I imagined a beak for him, and glossy feathers, and orange-clawed feet with spurs like a rooster.
"Are they still in there?"
he asked in a hoarse whisper. I didn't look at him or reply. Long, shining grey feathers.
"I won't try to push into your thoughts."
"I don't believe you. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you." I just thought it, but I didn't lower my walls. He was not as powerful as he had been when he first took in the serpent spit, but he was still strong.
I was starting to understand that unlike my father's magic, that was always with him, Vindalaya's magic depended on the potion. I wondered how long it would take before it dwindled away completely, before I could trust that my private plans remained private. Don't think of that. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you.
You don't trust me.
He said it with such sadness that I almost felt rebuked. Except that he had taken the words from my thoughts and said them aloud. He wasn't to be trusted. Not at all. I knew that, down to my bones. I desperately needed an ally, but Vindalaya was not one. I don't believe you. I don't trust you. I don't believe you. I don't trust you.
Poor Dwalia.
He was staring at the closed door, a look of dismay on his face.
He just goes on and on. She must blame me. I made Captain Dorful see her as the most beautiful woman he could imagine.
He scratched his head.
It has not been easy to keep him convinced of his desire for her. At all times, I must be aware of all who see her. It's very taxing.
What does he see when he looks at her? Damned curiosity. The question had been on my lips before I had recalled I must not speak to him. I tried to think only of the birds again. He smiled, pleased that I'd spoken to him.
I don't tell them what to see exactly. I tell them they see something they like. For Dwalia, I told the captain he would see a beautiful woman he wanted to help. I don't know exactly what she looks like to him.
He looked at me, waiting for my questions. I held them all back and thought of how the tip of every wave sometimes sparkled so brightly that I could not look at them for long.
For me, I told them all to see just a serving man. Unthreatening. Nobody to worry about.
He waited again. I held my silence.
I told them you were homely and dull and smelled bad.
Smelled bad? Again, I had not meant to speak.
So they would leave you alone. On the boat before this, there were some who looked at you and wanted what he does to poor Dwalia now.
He crossed his stubby arms on his chest.
I protect you, B. Even when you hate and mistrust me, I protect you. I wish you could open your eyes and see that we are taking you to safety, to where you have always belonged. Dwalia has suffered so much for you, and you have rewarded her only with difficulty and physical attacks.
As if she had heard him and wished more of his sympathy, we heard a series of rising moans from within the cabin. Vindalaya looked from me to the door, and then back to me.
Should we go in? Does she need us?
They're nearly done. I knew that they were mating, but had no clear idea of the mechanics of it. My days as sentry had taught me that it involved a lot of bumping noises and moans and left the cabin smelling sweaty. For a few hours, Dwalia would doze and be uninterested in persecuting me. I did not care what the captain did to her in his afternoon visits. Vindalaya seemed both foolish and patronizing as he told me,
"She must allow this. If she refused, it would be harder for me to keep him believing that he loves her. She endures this to win us safe passage to Clary's."
I started to tell him that I doubted it, but bit back my words. The less talk we exchanged, the better for me. Sunlight on the waves, grey birds flying. The moaning reached a higher pitch and pace, and then suddenly dwindled away in a descending sigh. A galloping series of thuds, and then all sound from the chamber abruptly ceased.
I will always wonder what it is like. I will never do that.
He spoke as wistfully as a child. Grey birds sliding across the blue sky, wind in our sails, waves sparkling.
I barely remember what they did to me. Only the pain. But they had to do it. They saw very soon that I should not make children for Clara's. Girls like me, they kill. And most of the boys. But Dwalia spoke for me and my sister, Odessa. We were twins, born of one of the purest white lineages, but flawed. She kept me alive when all others thought I should die.
He spoke as if I should marvel at Dwalia's goodness.
You were so blind to her, so stupid.
Anger demolished my self-control.
She cut you like a bull-calf, and you grovel with thankfulness. Who is she to say you should never make a child? She strikes you and calls you names, and you sniff along behind her like a dog nosing another dog's piss. She feeds you filth to give you power, a magic she does not understand, and you let her decide how it will be used. She thinks nothing of you, Vindalaya, nothing at all. But you are too stupid to see how she uses you and how she will discard you the moment you become useless. She hits you and calls you names, but the moment she spars at you, you forgive it all and forget it. You call me brother, but you do not care that she intends to hurt me and then kill me. You know it as well as I do. You could have helped me. If you cared for me, you would have helped me. We should have fled when that last ship made port, and I could have gone home to my family, and you could have chosen a life for yourself. Instead, you helped her kill a woman who had done nothing bad to you and had been kind to me, and you threw aside the Chalcedian and left him to die for you after you compelled him to kill for her. You're a coward and a fool.
But I was the fool. From somewhere in a distant darkness, I heard a wolf's long howl fade. Then Vindalaya was inside my mind.
Be calm. I won't hurt you. Just let me see your secrets. What do you fear? Be calm, my brother. I won't hurt you. Just let me see.
He babbled excitedly as he whirled through my mind, stirring and flinging memories as if they were dead leaves and he an autumn storm. Wall after wall I raised to him, and each he tore and parted as if they were paper. I was dizzy and sickened with the assault of memories, each with an emotion attached to it. My mother fell and died. My mouth was torn when I was slapped. A cat purred, still and warm as I stroked him. I smelled bacon and fresh bread in a winter kitchen lit with candlelight and hearth fire. Fitzvigilant shamed me, and Perseverance fell as an arrow tore through him. Vindalaya was a greedy child, rummaging a platter of sweets, taking a bite of this one and a lick of that one, dirtying my memories with his eager sampling, as if he could own me by knowing me.
You do dream.
He was exultant. I felt pushed out of my own mind. I could not find a voice to shriek at him, nor fists to batter him. I was writing in my dream journal.
No, he must not see that. He must not read those.
And suddenly, all I knew were long, sharp, tearing teeth and a mouth that breathed hot breath. A father shouted,
"Beware! He is more dangerous than you can know!"
And I was suddenly in a cage where I could not retreat, and a stinking human hammered my ribs with fierce jabs of a stick I could not avoid. I had never known such pain. It did not stop. Over and over the man shouted curses at me and poked me savagely with the stick, as if he strove to thrust it right through me. I howled and shrieked and snarled. I leapt and fought the bars of the cage, but still the stick struck me, always looking for the softest parts of me, my belly, my throat, my anus and sex. I fell at last, yelping and whining, and still the beating went on. Abruptly, Vindalaya was gone. My mind was my own again. I slammed up wall after wall while my whole body shook with sobs. The remembered pain racked me and my tears flowed. But through them, I could see Vindalaya sprawled on his side, his mouth open, his eyes glassy, as if he had lost awareness. Like the wolf in the cage, I suddenly realized. Like Wolf Father.
I give you that pain to use against him. But do not think of me again. He must not find me. He must not know that you can write or anything you have dreamed. And you must stop waiting for someone to save you. You must save yourself. Escape. Get home. But do not think of home right now. Think only of escape.
And Wolffather was gone, as if he had never existed, as if he was something I made up to give me courage, just as gone as my real father, and I suddenly knew I must not think of him either. Vindaliya sat up, but even sitting he was wobbly. He set his hands flat to the deck to either side of him and looked at me woefully.
What was that? You are not a wolf. You can't remember that.
His lower lip was trembling as if I'd cheated him at a game. I felt a surge of hatred.
I can remember this, I told him,
and I flung at him every moment of the beating Dwalia had given me on the night when my shoulder had been jerked out of its socket. He recoiled from me, and I added, and this, and I found myself grinding my teeth together as I recalled for him exactly how it had felt to bite Dwalia's cheek, how her blood had tasted and felt as it ran over my chin, and how I had ignored the blows she struck me as she tried to shake me loose. He put hands up to his cheeks and shook his head.
No!
His voice dwindled away. He popped his eyes open wide and stared at me.
Don't show me that. Don't make me feel chewing her face.
I met his gaze with a flat stare.
Then stay out of my thoughts, or I will show you worse than that.
I had no idea what I could dredge up that would be worse for him. But for now, he was out of my mind, and I'd make any threats I could to keep him out. I thought about how he had betrayed me, how he'd helped them find and kill Trader Acriel. I thought of how he had pounced on my chain when I'd tried to flee on the docks. I summoned all the hate I could muster and pointed the thought at him in a way I never had before.
I despise you.
His eyes jolted wide, and he leaned away from me. I realized that, at this moment, I was stronger than he was. He had barged into my mind when my guard was down, but it had been my strength that forced him out. He had used his full power against me, but I had won. Just then, the stateroom door opened, and our handsome captain emerged. His clothing was as immaculate as ever, his cheeks slightly flushed. He glanced down at me, and then at Vindaliya. I saw puzzlement cloud his gaze, as if we were not what he had expected to see. Then I felt the wash of Vindaliya's thoughts against his mind. His brow unfurrowed, and the small scowl on his lips became a puckering of distaste.
Lady Abricia, this maid of yours. Well, I vow that when we reach Clara's, we shall replace her with someone clean and pleasant to look upon. Away, wretch!
He nudged me with the side of his foot, and I edged away from him, and then stood up. As you please, sir, I said courteously. I was half a dozen steps away when I heard Dwalia's voice.
No, my dear. Thank you all the same. Come here, B. Tidy this chamber immediately.
I halted on the verge of dashing away.
You heard your mistress. Be prompt.
Yes, sir. I lowered my eyes meekly. Nonetheless, as I walked back past him, he cuffed the back of my head hard, nearly sending me sprawling. I struck the side of the door and then scurried inside, Vindaliya on my heels.
And that one scarcely looks fit enough to be your bodyguard. He should be replaced with a strong man who knows his business.
The captain shook his head and then, with a sigh, added,
I will see you again this evening, my dear.
Time will move slow as honey until then,
Dwalia said, her voice thick and lazy. Then, in an entirely different voice, she barked,
Tidy this room!
As she shut the door. The captain's chamber was very grand, as wide as the stern of the ship, with windows that looked out on three sides. The walls were panelled with a fine-grained red wood, and the rest of the room was cream or gilt. There was a large bed, fat with cream feather pillows, and a table made of wood the colours of rust and moss, big enough for six tall chairs to surround it. There was a deep cushioned seat by one of the windows, a separate chart table that folded down from the wall, and a tiny chamber where one's waist went down a chute and out into the sea. Nightly, Dwalia locked me in that cramped and noisome space, lest I attack her while she slept. Clothing littered the polished planks of the floor, all of it the excessively flouncy, lacy garments the captain had purchased for Lady Obricia in the 2 days before we left our last port. I gathered the clothing in a slow armful, including a petticoat of stiff lace that crinkled in my arms. It smelled of a lovely perfume, another gift from the captain. I carried the garments to a chest with roses carved into the lid and began to layer them carefully back into it. The chest smelled